everybody, and thank y'all again so very much for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives with me, Cam Hale. And I'm not alone. Braving the mud, Kyle Filson.
How's it going, everybody? Yes, I'm here in Skeleton Studios. Woo! The storms were pretty bad last
awesome.
Night.
You know, I love it.
I'm just a good-looking guy living in the middle of Tornado
what?
Alley, and
hold
it's that
on.
Time of year.
Hold on.
Yeah.
What? I guess you don't have mirrors. Go ahead.
You know, it gets this way every time of year. It's storm season here in Texas, and it was bad last night. Now, look, there are no trees broke over or anything like that, but it rained
just
good.
Just some good hard rain.
And you know, wouldn't you know it, it's right after I worked all weekend on the garden. I had a heck of a time. Look at my fingers. I smashed my fingers and stuff.
Yeah, that is a good one.
Sliced my fingers on stuff. I didn't cry, but I did put blood and sweat into the process just for a big old storm to come through and ripped out a whole bunch of stuff. So
messed up your cucumber garden.
Yeah. Man. It's okay, though. I got a good deal. If you go to Springtown, you can get cucumbers over there. Already started for like a dollar. I'm crying, but I may be out $5. It's not that big a deal.
I mowed my yard right before.
I'm going to grow those cucumbers and I'm going to make pickles.
Yes.
Right? All kinds of artisan. You like artisan pickles?
I just like pickles.
I like all kinds.
I do. I'm a big fan of pickles. And I used to not be, but it's my wife. She's always been a junkie for pickles for as long as I can remember. My kids are the exact same way. I mean, like, we almost have one whole shelf in our refrigerator with, like, if we go to a farmer's market and there's anything pickled, they want to try it.
Yeah.
I have pickled Brussels sprouts. I have pickled cauliflower. Okra. You name it.
I have a pickled
beans.
I have a pickled liver.
Yeah. Well, that is no joke. I have it all on the shelf in there. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to the pickling.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to your canning.
That's going to pop off. It'll pop off pretty quick. We'll see. Like we said, we got to see what the garden brings out when we start canning. But I think I'm going to start canning some meat next season, during deer season. I think I'm going to try a little bit of maybe some canned venison for later on. Nice soft. I don't know. We'll see. Because this is what story I've got for you, homie. An upright not deer pair. A pair of them.
A pair
were seen in Massachusetts in front of a couple, nonetheless. Listen to this.
I'm listening.
Says, okay, I want to start off by saying this, that I do not really believe in strange creatures from the abyss. And I'm not a huge fan of looking for Bigfoot. I'm just a regular guy who saw something that I cannot explain. And I just want to know if this is something maybe someone else has seen. I was driving down Route 20 in Northboro, Mass. Around 2 a.m. one night in 2007. Says I was on the road with my girlfriend at the time in the car with me. So we reached more of a wooded area and I saw two animals crossing the road. Both of them stopped and turned, looking at my oncoming car. When I saw them, I turned on my high beams, thinking, of course, they were deer. And after a brief moment, they both took about two steps and then just cleared the roads and were in the woods. I looked at my girlfriend, and she looked back at me and said, "Did you just see that? Those were not deer." We made a few jokes about it and ended up calling them these things on Route 20. They had fur on them that was about the length of a deer, so it was very short.
Now, was she saying that it was a not deer, or was she just saying that it was not deer?
She says those were not deer. She's not naming them. She's just saying that, like, it's not a cow, that's not a deer, that's not a dog. Like, she saw and, I guess, assumed by its movement and its shape that it was, but then she's like, that's not a deer.
Remember, I'm slow, so I'm just trying to follow along the story. Go ahead.
So this is, and they say they had short hair, just like on a deer, except that the fur was black, and said the height of these things would have been about 7 feet tall, that their eyes were reflective, like when a cat looks at you in the dark. The head was deer-like, except their ears that were pointed upwards, right? This is going to get...
Smell in the air again. Yeah. Remember, we talked about this.
Yes. They were standing upright on their back legs like a human would. Said it's difficult to describe what their legs look like, but the closest thing you can say is like a wolf's back legs, where it's only at the ends of the paws were touching the ground. And the ankle, if you will, is up off the ground, is what it says. So that's the way it's just on the tips of its hooves as it's walking off. And that's Tony sends that in. So what do you think about that?
It seems like there's more and more of this stuff going on.
Right.
And that was back from 2007. So that's 16 years ago.
So, and another thing too, that I think about is, you know, people point out, oh, this could be CWD.
Right.
Yeah.
Maybe right. This is CWD.
But why would that make them walk around on 2 feet?
I don't see CWD. No, no, you don't walk on your hind legs when you have CWD and you're not black. And I don't know. It just, the idea of seeing this thing, what does it sound like? It almost sounds like another, like a shapeshifter, or what is it like? We, you know, you think about a Wendigo, right? You think about something like that kind of creepy thing changing and transforming.
That is what I think about. What was the movie a couple of years ago?
Antlers.
Yeah, that's what it was.
Yeah.
About the Wendigo.
And we waited so long to watch it, and then... Dun, dun, dun,
dun. I have not seen the new Ghostbusters, but Luke loved it. He said it was fantastic.
Oh, well, we'll have to go check that out. I still haven't got to see the new Dune.
Oh, you didn't go this week?
No, I didn't get a chance to go. I've been working too much. Been helping my son too much.
I hear you. Well, check this out. It said, I decided that I wanted to share with y'all some of my grandfather's stories. He told me about his time working as a forester in Michigan's Ministi National Forest.
Nice.
He never got a chance to write any of his experiences down, so I thought I would tell y'all. For some background, my grandpa started working in the Ministi area in 1949. When he was only 28 years old. Before that, he had been drifting around the region, doing odd jobs and logging, until he was hired by the Forest Service in the northwest part of Michigan's Lower Peninsula. The work, as I understand, was slow, and most days he and his crew were sent to different parts of the forest to address various tree and land concerns. Grandpa was always an avid outdoorsman, and he enjoyed hunting and fishing just about as much as anyone else in the region. Sadly, he died in December of 1998, when I was still rather young, and it left me heartbroken. But I do remember whenever we went to visit him and Grandma, he would sit my brother and me down and tell us about his days in the Forest Service. Working outside every day allowed him to witness all sorts of wildlife, like black bears, whitetail, foxes, and even bobcats back in those days. He often relived his encounters with bears while he was deep in the forest, telling us that those moments were some of the most memorable of his entire life, being up close to such beautiful and powerful animals. Usually his tales were exciting, and the enthusiasm with which he told them inspired us to go out in the backyard and look for animals in between some of the pines. Although there wasn't much wildlife around Grandma, in Grandpa's property, they still always kept a close eye on us and never let us wander too far from the house. Finally, a few years before his death, Grandpa deemed my brother and me old enough to be told why. I was about 9, and my brother was about, 11, when Grandpa first opened up about the strangest things that had ever happened to him. All of our childhoods, we had heard him go on and on about the peace that the wilderness brought him. Or at least used to bring him. But this time, his tone was completely different. I don't remember all of the details, but I asked my brother to help piece together the parts of Grandpa's story, and my dad as well. He, too, had heard of the experiences in question multiple times. It was the mid-50s. I never did get the exact year. And it was October, and it had rolled in behind the cool autumn breezes and the sound of Canadian geese flying southward. The first of his strange stories had occurred at night, as he was driving home from a local bar where he and his crew had spent the last few hours after work. It was a windy night, and the pines on either side of the road were blowing ferociously. No moon or stars could be seen, though there was a lot of thick cloud cover. So the only illumination of the road ahead came from Grandpa's headlights. By his reckoning, he must have been going close to 50 miles per hour at the very moment when he saw something huge leap across the road not 20 feet ahead of him. His headlights had shown the animal's silhouette. He said it was dog-shaped, but massive, almost stretching all the way across the road. It only made one bound to get from one side to the other, and its size alone was enough to unnerve Grandpa. At the time, he had assumed that the animal was just a very large wolf, except timber wolves hadn't been spotted in that region for decades. He considered it a bizarre encounter, but nothing came of it that night, and he was able to return home without anything else strange happening to him. Now, the second of his stories admittedly frightened me, enough to avoid going outside at night for years, and even now I'm weary of noises in the dark because of the obvious fear in Grandpa's voice when he told us about his second experience. Some details here were provided by my father. It occurred in the same month as his first encounter, but only a few weeks later, on a night that was pretty cold for the season. It may have hit 40 degrees, but it was a calm night this time, with very little wind. Grandpa's house at the time was really small, and it stood in a lot with about six other similarly sized built edifices. None of his neighbors tended to stay up very late, so it surprised him to be awakened by loud noises at about 1 a.m. He said it sounded like something was scratching on sheet metal, with occasional thumps and bumps, like an animal was trying to get in. Grandpa apparently got up, fetched a flashlight, put on his boots, and went out into the front room, the walls of which consisted of mosquito screens stretched between wooden framework. Once in the front room, Grandpa could hear the sounds more clearly, and they were coming from the nearest of his neighbor's homes, maybe 50 yards to his right. It was incredibly dark out there, with no street lights to illuminate. The neighbor's house had a porch light on, but Grandpa couldn't make out what was creating the racket through the screen. So, he slowly opened the front door and looked out. He described to us in great detail the animal that he saw there. And he always said he would remember them exactly as they were, for fear brands memories the strongest. Three massive dogs, covered in long black hair, were up against his neighbor's house, scratching at the side and making visible claw marks with each swipe. Each beast stood about 7 feet tall, with their front legs stretching for another 2 or 3 feet, and easily reaching the roofing and the gutter of the house. Their scratching, however, did not make it seem like they were trying to get into the house, Grandpa explained. He thought they were doing that to get whoever was inside to come out. The next part was actually the hardest to get out of Grandpa. It was strange that he was so eager to tell us everything though so far, despite how he felt about the subject, but he was rather hesitant, as I remember him divulging into the last horrifying details about this encounter. He claims that the animals then noticed that he had emerged from his own house. They, just across the lawn from him, one at a time, turned and looked straight at him. Remind you, they were only 50 yards away. They had pointed ears like a wolf's and a huge body that rivaled large black bears in size. They also supported themselves not with 4 legs, like any other native mammal, but instead they stood on 2 legs, each towering 7 foot above the ground. The sounds that they proceeded to make, Grandpa said, would haunt his dreams for the rest of his life. It was a shame that he could neither produce recordings nor accurately mimic the unwolf-like screams the animals made, for that detail always fascinated me the most about his story. He said that they didn't sound like foxes or coyotes or bobcats. Instead, it was like a forced half-scream, half-howl out of their jaws, and Grandpa said he was sure they held teeth of a carnivore. Grandpa never told us exactly what happened next. I guess we assumed that he ran inside and locked the doors and didn't look outside again until early morning. He would tell us that 4 of his neighbors, including the elderly couple that lived in the nearest house, didn't stick around very long after that. He did say that he tried to talk to them about what had happened that night, but they remained evasive and never gave him really any straight answers. That turned out to be somewhat ironic because Grandpa himself kept tight-lipped about many of the details of his stories. He would say that he heard those exact screams on 2 other occasions, both times while he was out in the Menestee Forest, and he showed us an old Forest Service report detailing a possible timberwolf sighting in the area, complete with photographs of huge padded paw prints in the mud. The thing is, Grandpa never told anyone about his stories but his most trusted family, which is unique among Michigan dogman witnesses. After the craze of Steve Cook's legend song stirred in the 80s, it's no wonder that so many stories from the region surfaced. I had heard a few bits and pieces about the so-called monster before Grandpa told us his tale, but it wasn't until later in life that I realized his encounters had to have been with the same creature. Now, whether I believe him that massive wolves walk upright through Michigan forests, well, I'm not so sure. But as a modern zoological curiosity, the stories of strange beasts from passionate woodsmen who know their wildlife certainly remain among the most remarkable thing I've ever heard, simply because the genuine emotion with which he related his tales. Thanks for what you do, Kevin. Wow, that's crazy, right? Another one of these times where somebody's grandpa's like, hey, I got something I need to tell you. When I was a young man up in the woods, I saw this thing. It's crazy to me. And like, what were they doing trying to get in the neighbor's house? Is it possible that some of those neighbors actually were werewolves and they like locked the door? They forgot to unlock the door when they went out for the hunt that night. And they're like, man, we locked ourselves outside, and they're scratching and trying to get in.
Or maybe you lose that part of your thinking, right? You become more of animal than you do person. So you don't know how to operate the door.
You know, it reminds me of what was the movie? The Dog Soldiers. Remember when the girl like picks up those soldiers and they run to the house and it turns out she's a werewolf and the whole family, it's all like they just lured him there. It makes me wonder that kind of thing, because I hear dogman sightings from time to time, as do you and as the listeners. But it's very rare that you meet like a pack of them. And this was three of them or four of them.
They were like bikers from True Blood.
Yeah. Yeah. Crazy, crazy story. Well, let's take a break, folks. And when we get back from the break, I'm going to be talking about some more reincarnation stories, children with past life experiences. Stick with us, folks. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives.
Some young children say they have been here before. They give various details about previous lives, often describing the way in which they died. Of course, young children say lots of things, and we may simply think that they are fantasizing, as children often do. But what if, in a number of instances, people listened to the children and then tried to find out if the events they described had actually happened? And what if, when those people went to the places the children had named, they found that the children had said about the past events was indeed true? What then? Dr. Jurgen Kiel, a psychologist from Australia, listened as Kamal Atasoy, a 6-year-old boy in Turkey, confidently recounted details of a previous life that he had claimed to remember. They were meeting in the boy's home, a comfortable house in an upper-middle-class neighborhood, and with them were Dr. Kiel's interpreter and Kamal's parents, a well-educated couple who seemed amused at times by the enthusiasm that the boy showed in describing his experiences. He said that he had lived in Istanbul, 500 miles away. He stated that his family's name had been Caracas, and that he had been a rich Armenian Christian who lived in a large, 3-story house. The house, he said, was next to the house of a woman named Asigal, a well-known personality in Turkey, who had left the country because of legal problems. Kamal said that his house had been located on the water, where boats were often tied up, and that there was a church behind it. He said that his wife and children had Greek first names. He also said that he often carried a large leather bag, that he only lived in the house for part of the year. No one knew if Kamal's story was true when he met Dr. Keel in 1997. His parents did not know anyone in Istanbul. In fact, Kamal and his mother had never been there, and his father only visited the city twice on business. In addition, the family knew no Armenians. His parents were Alevi Muslims, a group with a belief in reincarnation. But they did not seem to think that Kamal's statements, which he'd been making from the time he was just a toddler of 2 years of age, were particularly that important. Dr. Keel set out to determine if the statements that Kamal had given first with someone who had actually lived. The work that Dr. Keel had to perform to find out if such a person even existed demonstrates that Kamal could not have come across the details of the man's life by accident. When Dr. Keel and his interpreter went to Istanbul, they found the house of Asigal, the woman who Kamal had named. Next to the house was an empty three-story residence that precisely matched Kamal's description. It was at the edge of the water, where boats were tied up, with a church behind it. Dr. Keel then had trouble finding any evidence that a person like the one Kamal described had ever lived there. No Armenians were living in that part of Istanbul at the time, and Dr. Keel could not find anyone who remembered any Armenians ever having lived there. When he returned to Istanbul later that year, he talked with Armenian church officials, who told him that they were not aware that an Armenian had ever lived in that house. No church records indicated that one had, but a fire had destroyed many of the records. Dr. Keel then talked with an elderly man in the neighborhood who said that an Armenian had definitely lived there, but it was a long time ago, many years before, and that the church officials were simply too young to remember that long ago. Armed with that report, Dr. Keel decided to continue his search for information. The next year, he made a third trip to the area and interviewed a well-respected local historian. During the interview, Dr. Keel made sure that he did not prompt any answers or make any type of suggestions. The historian told a story strikingly similar to the one that Kamal had told. The historian said that a rich Armenian Christian had, in fact, lived in that house. He had been the only Armenian in that area, and his family's name was Karakas. His wife was Greek Orthodox, and her family did not approve of the marriage. The couple had three children, but the historian did not know their names. He said that the Karakas clan lived in another part of Istanbul, and that they dealt in leather goods, and that the deceased man in question often carried a large leather bag. He also said that the deceased man lived in the house only during the summer months of the year. He had died in 1940 or 1941. Though Dr. Keel was not able to verify Kamal's statement that the wife and children had Greek first names, the wife came from a Greek family and was Greek Orthodox. The first name that Kamal had given for the man turned out to be an Armenian term meaning nice man. Dr. Keel could not confirm that people actually called Mr. Karakas that, but he was struck by the fact that even though no one around him knew the expression, Kamal had given a name that could easily have been used to describe Mr. Karakas. How did this little boy, living in a town 500 miles away, know so many things about a man who had died in Istanbul 50 years before he was born? He could not have heard about the man Dr. Keel had to work so hard to learn anything about. What possible explanation can there be? Kamal had a very simple answer. He said that he had been the man in a previous life. Now, Kamal, well, he's not alone in his claims. Children all over the world have described memories of previous lives. For more than 40 years, researchers have investigated these reports. More than 2,500 cases are registered in the files of the Division of Personality Studies at the University of Virginia. Some of the children said they were deceased family members. Others described previous lives as strangers. In a typical case, a very young child begins to describe memories of another life. This child is persistent about this and often demands to be taken to his other family in another location. When the child is given names or enough details about the other location, the family often goes there to find that the child's statements fit the life of a person who has died in the recent past. Were Kamal and the other 2,500 children remembering what they thought they were remembering? Events from lives they had previously experienced? The question has occupied researchers for years. No one really knows. But I think the subject matter is fascinating. I don't see how it could be anything other than reincarnation. Let's take a look at a couple more cases. John McConnell, a retired New York City policeman working as a security guard, stopped at an electronics store after work one night in 1992. He saw two men robbing the store and pulled out his pistol. Another thief, behind a counter, began shooting at him. John tried to shoot back, and even after he fell, he got up and shot again. He was hit 6 times. One of the bullets entered his back and sliced through his left lung, his heart, and the main pulmonary artery, the blood vessel that takes blood from the right side of the heart to the lungs to receive oxygen. He was rushed to the hospital, but did not survive. John had been close to his family and had frequently told one of his daughters, Doreen, that no matter what, I'm always going to take care of you. 5 years after John died, Doreen gave birth to a son named William. William began passing out soon after he was born. The doctors diagnosed him with a condition called pulmonary valve atresia, in which the valve of the pulmonary artery has not adequately formed, so blood cannot travel through it to the lungs. In addition, one of the chambers of his heart, the right ventricle, had not formed properly, and as a result of the problem with the valve, he underwent several surgeries. Although he will need to take medication indefinitely, he has done quite well. William had birth defects that were very similar to the fatal wounds suffered by his grandfather. In addition, when he became old enough to talk, he began talking about his grandfather's life with crazy accuracy. One day, when he was just 3 years old, his mother was at home trying to work in her study when William kept acting up. Finally, she got on to him. "Sit down, or I'm going to spank you." And William said, "Mom, when you were a little girl, I was your daddy, and you were bad a lot of times, and I never hit you." His mother was initially taken back by this comment. As Williams talked more about the life of his grandfather, she began to feel comforted by the idea that her father had indeed returned. William talked about it being his grandfather a number of times and discussed his death. He told his mother that several people were shooting during the incident when he was killed, and he asked a lot of questions about it. One time he said to his mother, "When you were a little girl and I was your daddy, what was my cat's name?" She responded, "You mean Maniac?" "No, not that one," William responded. "The white one." "Boston?" his mom asked. "Yeah," William responded. "I used to call him Boss, right?" That was correct. The family had two cats named Maniac and Boston, but only John referred to the white one as Boss. One day, Doreen asked William if he remembered anything about the time before he was born. He said that he died on a Thursday and went to heaven. He said that he saw animals there and also talked to God. He said, "I told God I was ready to come back, and I got born on a Tuesday." Now, Doreen was amazed that William mentioned days, since he didn't even really know his days of the week yet, without prompting at least. She tested him again by saying, "So you were born on a Thursday and died on a Tuesday?" He quickly responded, "No, I died Thursday at night and was born Tuesday in the morning." He was correct on both counts. John did indeed die on a Thursday, and William was born on a Tuesday 5 years later. He talked about the period between lives at other times. He told his mother, "When you die, you don't go right to heaven. You go to different levels, here, then here, then here." As he moved his hand up each time, he said that animals are reborn as well as humans, and that animals he saw in heaven did not bite or scratch. John had been a practicing Roman Catholic, but he believed in reincarnation and said that he would take care of animals in his next life. His grandson, William, says that he will be an animal doctor and will take care of large animals at a zoo. William reminds Doreen of her father in several ways. He loves books, as his grandfather did, and when they visit William's grandmother, he can spend hours looking at these books in John's study, duplicating his grandfather's behaviors from years before. William, like his grandfather, is good at putting things together and can be a nonstop talker. William especially reminds Doreen of her father when he tells her, "Don't worry, Mom, I'll take care of you." Patrick Christensen is a boy who was born by cesarean section in Michigan in 1991. When the nurses brought him to his mother, she immediately felt that he was connected to her first son, who had died of cancer at the age of 2 in 1979, 12 years earlier. She soon noticed that Patrick displayed 3 defects that matched those of her other son when he died. Her first son, Kevin, began to limp when he was 1.5 years old. One day he fell and broke his left leg. This led to a medical workup that included a biopsy of a nodule on his scalp right above the ear. Doctors diagnosed him with metastatic cancer. A bone scan showed many abnormal sites. His left eye was protruding and bruised due to a tumor. He received chemotherapy through a central line, a large IV line in the right side of his neck. Though the site on his neck where the chemotherapy agents were entering his body became flushed and slightly swollen several times, he had no major problems with the treatment and was eventually discharged home. He received outpatient treatment but returned to the hospital 5 months later. At that point, he appeared blind in his left eye. He was admitted with a fever, treated with antibiotics, and discharged from the hospital. He died 2 days later, 3 weeks after his second birthday. Now, Kevin's parents had separated before his death, and his mother eventually remarried. She gave birth to a daughter and son before Patrick was born. Now, at birth, he had a slanting birthmark with the appearance of a small cut on the right side of his neck, the same location of Kevin's central line. A nodule on his scalp above his right ear, as Kevin's biopsied tumor had been, and opacity in his left eye, diagnosed as corneal leukemia, that caused him, like Kevin, to have very little vision in that eye. When he began walking, he limped, favoring his left leg. When Patrick was almost 4.5 years old, he began telling his mother things that she felt were related to the life of Kevin. He talked for some time about wanting to go back to their previous home and told his mother that he had left her there. He said that the home was orange and brown, which was correct. He asked his mother if she remembered him having surgery, and when she replied that he hadn't had any surgery, he said that he had pointed to the area above his right ear where Kevin had his nodule biopsied. He also said that he did not remember the actual surgery because he was asleep when it was done. At another time, Patrick saw a picture of Kevin, whose pictures were not normally displayed in the family's home, and said that that was a picture of him. After Patrick began making his statements, his mother contacted Carol Bauman, an author who has written two books about children who talk about previous lives, Children's Past Lives and Return from Heaven. They talked on the phone a number of times, with Carol offering guidance on how to deal with the past life issues that seemed to be coming up. She eventually referred the case for investigation to other doctors, and Dr. Stevenson and a man named Jim Tucker visited the family when Patrick was 5 years old. When they were there, they saw and photographed the birthmark on Patrick's neck, a 4-millimeter dark slanting line on the lower part of the right side of his neck that looked like a healed cut. The nodule on his head was very hard to see but easy to palpate, so they documented the small mass when they felt it there. They could see the opacity in Patrick's left eye and obtained copies of the eye exams that he had received. They watched him walk and could easily determine that he had a slight limp, despite having no medical condition that would explain it. They obtained Kevin's official medical records, and they documented the history described earlier, including the lesions that appeared to correspond to Patrick's subsequent birthmarks. They took Patrick to the home that Kevin had shared with his mother. Patrick, unfortunately, did not have a great enunciation that could be difficult to understand at times, but he did not make any statements that definitely indicated that he did not recognize the home. In summary, Patrick had three unusual lesions at birth that appeared to correspond to lesions that of his half-brother, Kevin, had suffered. In addition, he limped when he began walking and also alluded to events in Kevin's life whenever he was talking to his mother. How could this be anything other than reincarnation? I mean, I don't think you can argue it. I love the stories of the birthmarks that people, that transitions from one life to another. And what's odd is as these children get older, their memories kind of dissipate. And as they dissipate, the physical birthmarks dissipate too. Like, what is going on? Let's check out another one. Kanai Kumamaliwong was born in central Thailand in 1967 with two birthmarks, one on the back of his head and one above his left eye. When he was born, his family did not think that the birthmarks were that particularly significant, but when he was 3 years old, he began talking about a previous life. He said that he had been a schoolteacher named Buakai, and that he had been shot and killed while on the way to school. He gave the names of his parents, his wife, and two of his children from that life, and he persistently begged his grandmother, with whom he lived, to take him to his previous parents' home in a place called Khao Phra. Eventually, when he was still 3 years old, his grandmother did just that. She and Kanai took a bus to a town near Khao Phra, which was 15 miles from their home village. After the two of them got off the bus, Kanai led the way to a house where he said his parents lived. The house belonged to an elderly couple whose son, Buakai Lanak, had been a teacher who was murdered 5 years before Kanai was born. Kanai's grandmother, it turned out, had previously lived 3 miles away. Since she had a stall where she sold goods to many people in the surrounding area, she vaguely knew Buakai and his wife. She had never been to their home and had no idea to whose home Kanai was leading her. Now, once there, Kanai identified Buakai's parents, who were there with a number of other family members, as his own. They were impressed enough by his statements and his birthmarks to invite him to return a short time later. But when he did, they tested him by asking him to pick out Buakai's belongings from others, and he was able to do that. He recognized one of Buakai's daughters and asked for the other one by name. Now, Buakai's family accepted that Kanai was Buakai reborn, and he visited them a number of times. He insisted that Buakai's daughter call him father, and if they did not, he refused to talk to them. As for Buakai's wounds, no autopsy report was available, but Dr. Stevenson talked with a number of the family members about his injuries, and they said that he had two wounds on his head from being shot. His wife remembered that the doctor who examined Buakai's body, said that the entrance wound was the one on the back of his head because it was much smaller than the wound on his forehead that would have been the exit wound. Now, these matched Kanai's birthmarks, a small, circular one on the back of his head and a larger, more irregular one on the front. They were both hairless and puckered. No one photographed them until Kanai was 11 and a half years old, so determining exactly where they were on his head at birth is difficult. But in the photographs, the larger one is on the left, towards the top of his head in front. But witnesses said that it had been lower on his forehead when he was younger. In that case, a number of witnesses stated that a young child with birthmarks that matched the entrance and exit wounds on a deceased man had knowledge about the man's life and that he seemingly could not have attained them through normal means. He was able to pass tests that the man's family constructed for him, and I tell you, it can't be anything other than reincarnation. Before we get out of here, I got one more. This is a famous case, probably one of my favorites, took place right here in Texas and Louisiana. It is the case of James Linegar. James Linegar is the son of Bruce and Andrea Linegar, a Protestant couple in Louisiana in the United States. Beginning at the age of 2, James made statements and demonstrated behaviors that suggested that he remembered the life of an American pilot killed during World War II. James was born on April 10, 1998. As related by his parents, the first noticeable incident in the case occurred in February of 2000, when he was only 22 months old. His father at that time took him to the Kavanaugh Flight Museum outside of Dallas, Texas, as they were living in Texas at the time. James was fascinated by airplanes, and in particular, by the World War II ones. When they left after 3 hours, James had 2 toy planes, as well as a video called It's Kind of Magic about the Blue Angels, the Navy flight exhibition team. James loved the video, and he watched it repeatedly for weeks. The trip and the video started or uncovered his love for planes. This passion may have led to some of the knowledge of the planes and flying that James often surprised his parents by voicing. The video, however, was not clearly was not the source of James' information about World War II, since the Blue Angels group was founded in 1946 after the war had ended. James and his father made a second trip to the museum later that spring, on Memorial Day weekend. James was again excited throughout his time there, though he grew quiet in the hangar that housed the World War II aircraft. He stood, staring and pointing at the planes, as if in awe. Within 2 months of the first trip, James developed a habit of saying, "Airplane crash, on fire," and slamming his toy planes nose first into the family's coffee table. He repeated this behavior over and over, producing dozens of scratches and dents on the table. Now, James' father traveled a lot, and when James and his mother would see him off at the airport, James would often say, "Daddy, airplane crash, on fire." Now, this happened repeatedly, despite his father's admonishments. Around this time, James began having nightmares. His behavior during these times seemed to have involved only screams at first, but then included words as well. "Airplane crash, on fire. Little man, can't get out. Airplane crash, plane on fire. Little man, can't get out." He would just repeat this in these very vivid nightmares. James would shout this over and over while thrashing about and kicking his legs up in the air. After a few months of this, he had several conversations with his parents about the dreams, usually as he was preparing to go to sleep. He indicated that there were memories of events from the past. He said that his plane had crashed on fire and that it had been shot down by Japanese. 2 weeks after those statements, James said his plane was a Corsair, which was a type of fighter plane that was developed during World War II. He talked about flying a Corsair several times. on August 27, 2000, when James was 28 months old, he told his parents that he had flown his plane off of a boat. When his parents asked him the name of the boat, he said, Natoma. After that conversation, his father searched online for the word and eventually discovered the description of the USS Natoma Bay, an escort carrier stationed in the Pacific during World War II. He printed out the information he found, and the footer of the printout included a date. James' parents asked him a number of times for the name of the little man in his dreams, and he always responded with, "Only me," or "James." A few weeks after James gave the word Natoma, his parents asked him if he could remember anyone else who was with the little man. James responded with the name Jack Larson. Now one day, James was just over 2.5. His father was looking through a book he was planning to give his own father for Christmas, one called The Battle for Iwo Jima, 1945. His father reported that James pointed to a picture showing an aerial view of the base of the island, where Mount Suribachi, a dormant volcano, sits, and said, "That's where my plane was shot down." His father said, "What?" And James responded, "My airplane got shot down right there, Daddy." A week after that, James' father talked to a veteran from the Natoma Bay who remembered a pilot named Jack Larson. He said Larson flew off one day and never returned, so no one knew what happened to him. With the ongoing nightmares, James' parents eventually contacted Carol Bowman, remember that name, who had written a book about children's past lives. They began a lengthy correspondence. Following Bowman's advice, James' mother started acknowledging to him that the events he was describing had indeed happened to him before, while emphasizing that they were in the past and that he was completely safe now. The nightmares then began to gradually grow less and less violent, and less frequent. James' parents said that when he became old enough to draw, he drew hundreds of battle scenes involving planes. He signed them James III. When his parents asked him about this, he said that the three referred not to his age, but to him being the third James, as he continued to sign his pictures that way even after he turned four. James may have thought of himself as the third James because James Huston, the pilot, was James Jr. In June of 2002, James' parents were interviewed by ABC News for a segment that was part of a program called Strange Mysteries. That program never aired. Now, at the time of the interview, Huston had not been identified. Following the interview, James' father corresponded with an ABC producer about the name Jack Larson. She had a contact at the Center for Naval History who found a John M. Larson. 2 months later, James' father wrote a letter to a veteran who had told him that Jack Larson had served on the Natoma Bay. In the letter, he mentions this John M. Larson. A month after that, James's father attended his first Natoma Bay reunion. He learned that Jack Larson from Natoma Bay had survived the war, that he was not at the reunion, but he still was alive, and James' father soon visited him. He also learned that only one pilot from the ship was lost during the Battle of Iwo Jima, a 21-year-old from Pennsylvania named James M. Huston Jr. After the reunion, James's father turned his focus to Huston, as documented by a posting he made on a website looking for more information. He learned that Huston did not actually die on Iwo Jima itself. Instead, as the battle continued after the initial assault, he was one of 8 pilots from the ship who took part in a strike against transport vessels in a harbor on nearby Chichijima, as the Japanese were preparing a buildup of troop replacements and supplies. His plane appears to have crashed exactly as James had described. The aircraft action report for the day that Huston's plane was shot down includes a chart of the paths that each pilot took. Jack Larson, the one named James gave, is shown as the pilot of the plane next to Huston's. as Huston was the only pilot from the Natoma Bay killed during the Iwo Jima operation, and his details closely matched James' statements, his parents concluded that he was the man whose life James had recalled. There's no doubt, right? How could the boy know such details? We're talking about a young boy. How would he have known the name of the ship? The name of a guy that was on the ship, who happened to later be proven was on that ship. I mean, and the knowing the exact way the guy died. I mean, I don't know if you need any more proof. I don't. I find these stories fascinating. I hope you do too. I'm Kyle Filson. This is Expanded Perspectives.
Expanded Perspectives.
Wow.
I love these stories because they're so incredible that it, I mean, there's just no way to explain it other than reincarnation is real. I mean, there's lots of cultures that it's not a theory they have. They believe it. And here in the Western world, I don't know why it's so easily dismissed or denied. After reading some of these stories, it's absolutely, I believe in reincarnation.
It's like you get a choice. Maybe you can go on someplace else, or yeah, you can go back and try again. See what you want to do. What do you want to? You want to go on the same ride again, or do you, what? You never ridden the roller coaster twice?
Yeah, maybe. Maybe right? It's a punishment. Like if you messed up, you're gonna go. You got to go back and do it again. Like oh, no, nope, go back
fact,
to the line.
Then I've been reincarnated hundreds of thousands of times,
and you're still not getting it right.
I still can't
so you'll
get
be coming
it right.
back.
Right? Yeah, I'll be back. I still can't get this right.
Yeah, or you know, some cultures think you come back as an animal.
Yeah,
you know, like you might come back as a jackrabbit next time, or. I don't know.
I know what you could come back as, Kyle.
A jackass?
A huge horned howling mountain monster.
Now that would be a pretty cool comeback, yeah.
That would be pretty cool because they've spotted one in Madison County, North Carolina.
Wait a minute. You had a horned werewolf last week.
Yep, I did.
Now you got a horned what?
A huge horned howling mountain monster.
Okay.
Yeah, that sounds amazing.
It's a cool right? title, yeah.
Lon has the best titles. This is what it, now get a load of this. You're going to like this because this came from Fairfield, South Carolina. It was the Herald there on March 12th of 1873.
Oh, so this is a long time
ago. Oh, this is back in the day. Says a gentleman recently from the Shelton Laurel District of North Carolina, some 40 miles. Should I try my North Carolina accent? And I was
sure.
making fun of with sure. Mike. No, I'm not going to do it. Try to get real mountainous like that with Mike. But anyway, says 40 miles from this place informs us that the people in the densely thicketed county are greatly excited in regard to the appearance upon several different places of a huge mountain monster, the species of which is unknown. Mr. George Anderson, one of the gentlemen residing in the Laurel country, being one of the persons who saw the monster, also furnishes us with the following description of it. I was out in the bush hunting up some lost hogs when all of a sudden there came into my path a beast, that the appearance of which, I must confess, caused me to quake for the first time in many years. Aside from its strange and unusual appearance, the unearthly yell it uttered on perceiving me, which reverberated and reverberated through the forest, was enough to shake the sense of the most daring adventurer. I love the writing back then. The animal was some 100 yards distance from me and appeared to be a huge black bear with mane and head like a lion, but it had horns like that of an elk upon it. Its tail was long and bushy, with dark and light rings around its extremity. Its eyes gleamed like a panther's, and its size was that of an ordinary ox, but somewhat longer. Just previous to making its appearance, I'd heard shot off my gun at a squirrel and felt little prepared to meet such a ferocious beast without any weapon of defense. I immediately set about reloading my rifle, but the scarcity begun when it darted towards me. I retreated in as good order as possible and must say I did some good running, not looking back until I found the animal had disappeared in the laurel thicket. This is no story, Mr. Editor, gotten up to scare naughty children. I am not the only one who has seen the monster. Several have seen it, as I did, and as sheep and calves are lately missing. It is presumed to be a carnivorous brute. Many have fortified their houses to prevent a night attack from the strange monster, the like of which was never seen in these mountains before. Some think it has escaped from some rambling menagerie, while others superstitiously think it is sent to warn people of some great approaching danger.
I love the writing of the time, and I don't know for whatever reason, but when you go back that far back, it seems more believable to me. Like, I don't know why. It's just like, oh, that happened a long time ago. Yeah, I don't know.
It's bigger than a bull. Like, it's like ox size with horns. It's longer. It's, dude, what could you mistake in that thing for? You can't.
Yeah, I don't know.
It's either an elk or it's not.
Yeah.
That's it.
Well, before we get out of here, I got a pretty cool possible Glimmer Man sighting.
Here we go.
It says, I've been reading about the Glimmer Man phenomenon and its similarity to the cloaked alien in the Predator film series. I saw something very similar a few years ago. It was probably around 4 years ago. I lived in the very northern part of Frederick County in Maryland near Thurmont, not too far south of Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. Behind my house was a few acres of woods with a small creek right past the tree line. We have about 2 acres of lawn before the woods start. This area of Frederick County is very rural, with lots of forest and farms, very near Cunningham Falls State Park, a huge wooded area with lakes and the tallest waterfall in the state. In fact, Camp David is located in this area. Anyway, I was sitting on my second story back deck and noticed some movement in the tree line. It was a nice day. I think early fall. It was not a hot day and it was not raining. I saw what looked like the outline of something big moving perpendicular away from me in the woods. It was a shimmer, like heat waves, completely invisible, except you can see the air being displaced. And made me think of the Predator right away, because it was just like the heat waves rising from a hot surface. It seemed to be humanoid in shape, and it was a little taller than it was wide, like a tall, fit, bipedal outline. It was hard to judge the height from my perspective and the distance, but it was taller than the average man. I would guess maybe 10 feet tall. I never heard of someone else seeing something similar before. I only saw it once, and that was enough for me. Alex. Tall, 10 foot, that's real tall.
Yikes.
Taller, a little bit taller than the average man. That's like double the height of an average man.
Yikes.
Again, a lot of people aren't aware of this phenomenon until they see it, and they're like, think of the movie. And then they later find out that, like, lots of people have been seeing this.
Yeah.
And then they're like, oh, yeah, I didn't know this was a thing. Yeah, I definitely saw that. I love the stories of the Glimmer Man.
I love them.
I do not know what it is, but it seems like something from a parallel dimension or perhaps extraterrestrial. I don't know. I like it. So if you have any Glimmer Man sightings, feel free to email the show expandedperspectives@yahoo.com. Or if you have any other stories of any kind, you can email us the story to the same email. You can call the show 888-393-2783. And I also want to tell everybody about Expanded Perspectives Elite. If you want to support me and Cam in the show and you want more episodes, go to patreon.com/expandedperspectivesElite or go on the app and just search up Expanded Perspectives Elite. And you can sign up and help the show. It's fun. It's great. It's good, right? It's a community over there.
That's right.
We've had a lot of people moving over. that's it's worked out far better than I thought it was going to, which I'm glad, because I was a little bit apprehensive about shutting down the old platform and moving to the new one. But
he hates technology, folks.
Change is tough, right? Everybody, even you and your family, you guys are going to be going through some changes soon. Oh, yeah.
Yep.
Change is scary, but, you know, lots of times it's like, man, it works out so much better.
It does.
So, you know, everybody gets stuck in a rut.
Well, then it's fun to shake things up from time to time.
It is. And speaking of shaking things,
yeah.
Have you been shaking any rattle traps or anything? I heard you want to do some fishing again. You found this jam up spot.
Oh, yeah. We've got a few good spots to go to.
It's private, and only you and your son are allowed there. Oh, hey, so I'm jealous. And you're going to take the kayaks, you said, and do some sleigh.
This is going to happen. This is going to happen soon. Yeah. As soon as we get a little more time, I think we're going to try to bust out and go one day, you know, Monday during the week or whatnot. But yeah, this place is going to be gnarly. I can't wait to go. To go wet more hooks out there. It'll be good times.
Now is the time.
Oh, yeah. And we need to go striper fishing, too. And I think the sand bass are running, from what I understand. So
I spent the whole day with Pop, my mom, and my wife and Luke. We went to Trader's Village and walked around all day. And it was a good time. We had a lot of fun.
The weather was good for it.
Yeah, Luke found, of course, some retro video games for his Dreamcast.
He's the best at it.
Yeah.
Because he can find he's
reincarnated. He's an old soul. I 100% believe that.
Yeah.
So
100% that's him.
That's what we did. And like I mentioned earlier in the beginning of the show, Luke went and watched the new Ghostbusters. He gave it a thumbs up. So if you're thinking about going to see that, I heard it was good.
He needs to start doing his own movie reviews, horror movie reviews and things like that.
He's into editing and stuff, but I don't know what he's working on. Him and a couple of his classmates are always working on
something. Doing more stop motion?
I wish they would. He hasn't done any stop motion in a while, but he was doing that. I think he's figured out. I mean, look, he knows how to work Adobe Premiere better than me. Like, I have to ask him questions if I'm working on a project. I'm like, how do you do that again? How do you import that? He's like, oh, yeah, you just do this. Self-taught. But, him and his buddies are always working on something like that. You know, I wish that was something they would teach in school. Like, remember back when we were kids, you had to take home economics. Like, it was mandatory. You know, they teach you how to cook, how to wash stuff, how to balance a checkbook, basic stuff for life. They don't do that anymore. I wish they had classes where they taught, instead of like metal shop, they taught kids like video and editing, audio editing.
Just add it where you can pick what you want to do.
Yeah, well, that's true. Yeah.
That's what we need.
That's what we need.
We just need more funding for it.
Yeah. That's the complaint, right? Yep. You hear that, but I'm like, come on. Look at the amount of money we waste on nonsense. You can't get metal shop in school no more.
Right. I can't weld.
It's a different world, folks. It's a different world. Well, Cam, what do you got planned for your next upcoming weekend? It's going to be Easter, so.
I'm not sure. My wife has some plans, something carved out to what we're going to be doing, but I'm not 100% sure. So I know we got some big family stuff, I believe, both days. I think Saturday and Sunday we have big family things going on. So
you're
going to
be dyeing eggs and hiding
them? I'm sure. Yeah, I'm sure the granddaughter's coming over. I'm sure we'll be doing a little egg dyeing and whatnot. And we had a birthday party this past weekend. One of my nieces, my great nieces, she turned 9. So we had a heck of a party and all the littles were there and they were going crazy. And it was something else. It was a lot of fun. So yeah,
awesome.
Looking forward to that. Weather's getting better. Like I said, fishing, spring turkey season. We got a lot of stuff coming up.
That is awesome. Yes, I hope everybody out there has a safe and happy Easter. That's about all the time we have for this episode. Till next time, folks, I'm Kyle. He's Cam.
Peace, y'all.